This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Jonathan Bastian, in for Steve Chiotakis. We're beginning today's story at a Travelodge at the corner of 186th Street and Normandy in South LA.
So we walked up here to 203.
This is where Paul Alleen quarantined for 2 weeks after being released from San Quentin.
We walked under here and went to the underground garage, and really, this was like my first taste of freedom.
Alleen is one of thousands of Californians getting out of prison early during the pandemic. Back in March, the state worked quickly to release 3,500 inmates. Today, that number has jumped to over 17,000. But Alleen's release story is a bit different from most of the other newly freed.
I'm someone who served a 24-year, 8-month sentence for conspiracy to commit murder for hire, attempted murder and robbery. And I just got released from prison on July 21st.
Most prisoners getting out early qualify under new pandemic rules. Alleen doesn't, because he committed a violent crime. Instead, he's out now because he had already been found suitable for parole, and the state moved up his date. So how is the state of California making these decisions about who stays in and who gets out? And should people like Alleen be kept in prison? Or should they be the first in line to get out? Reporter Lucy Kopp has the story.
Let's go back to late May, right before San Quentin Prison would be splashed across national headlines as the site of the worst COVID outbreak in the country.
It hadn't exploded yet. When I say exploded, I mean chaos in general.
Alleen remembers when things took a sudden turn. San Quentin had been able to stave off the virus all spring. But that changed in June, when the state decided to transfer 121 men from a hotspot prison in Chino to San Quentin. This transfer is now considered the most botched and deadly transfer in state history.
I very distinctly remember that around the 18th, guys said, hey, there's a little cold going around the building. And usually when you hear that in San Quentin or most prisons, by the time you hear it, you probably already got it.
The virus exploded, and it quickly became clear that the prison could no longer separate the positive cases from the negative ones.
They realized that they were running out of room. There's so many people that are positive. We can't keep taking the positive guy and sending him to Badger and then the negative cellie and sending him to Alpine. We don't have enough room for that.
Officers began calling out of work, afraid for their own lives. Nurses were short-staffed, and Alleen's building of 780 men were losing patients.
They're neglecting things like our showers, medications coming late, and so, you know, this is how things are starting to deteriorate.
Then Alleen's cellmate tested positive for COVID-19. Alleen quickly got it too, but had mild symptoms. He listened to the echoes of people calling man down, sometimes 2 to 3 times a day.
We're in there in our cells watching TV, and we're seeing guys that just got released protesting for us saying, you know, let them go. You're killing them in there. Get them some help.
On June 29th, Governor Newsom addressed the crisis at a televised news conference.
We are committed to meeting our responsibilities within CDCR. And moreover, as we release prisoners, the impact that will have outside of...
When I saw him start to stumble over his words and start making promises about we're going to reduce the population. I promise you I'm going to get... I was flabbergasted. I said, this is having an effect.
The state decided to release 8,000 more incarcerated people on top of the 3,500 who were already released early in the spring. If you had 180 days left on your sentence for a nonviolent crime, you qualified. If you were medically high risk and had a year left on your sentence for a nonviolent crime, you qualified. The governor's focus was on so-called non-non-nons, those in prison for non-serious, non-violent, non-sexual crimes. Alleen did not qualify, but should he have?
Well, we're not taking into consideration if a person has been in prison for 20 years and they've gone through all of these rehabilitative programs and they haven't committed a violent offense in the past 20 years or 15 years, they're no longer a violent offender.
That's Sam Lewis, director of the Anti-Recidivism Coalition. I should note, I produce a podcast called Life on the Outside that is partnered with this organization. Lewis's point is that most incarcerated people who have life sentences and then qualify for release qualify because they are no longer likely to be violent. Lifers have the lowest recidivism rate of any group of formerly incarcerated people, at under 1%. They also tend to be older, adding to the unlikelihood they'll reoffend. On the other hand, their age puts many of them at high risk for COVID-related complications.
Lifers usually know themselves better than any of us out here will ever know ourselves. They have had to look at their lives in a really deep manner.
Vanessa Nelson Sloan is the director of Lifer Support Alliance. She says if you have a life sentence, you need to earn your freedom. And you do that by gaining insight into your crime, showing remorse, and taking full responsibility. This is part of the reason the recidivism rate amongst lifers is so low. But, she says, the public sees it differently.
The public has a really warped perception of prisoners, but lifers in particular. They seem to see all of these folks as totally bloodthirsty, unaccountable murderers with no remorse. And that is not the case.
Back in 2008, a California Supreme Court case considered this question. Should people serving life sentences for violent crimes be considered for release if they no longer present a danger to society? The court answered yes, ruling in favor of the release of someone like Aline. That's part of the reason why in the last decade, more lifers in California are being found suitable for parole and released back into society than ever before. But victims and crime survivor groups have been rattled by this trend.
Victims and survivors and family members are devastated.
That's Patricia Winskunas. She runs the Crime Survivors Resource Center, and she's witnessing firsthand how these early releases are alarming crime survivors.
We've been contacted by many recently saying they were getting early release notices, and so they're triggered, they're traumatized, they're having night terrors, they're not sure what to do, even though, yes, maybe this person did serve their time, but that doesn't mean that that person now is not going to come after that person. There's no guarantee either way.
Winskunas says that with the momentum shifted towards rehabilitation, victims' voices are left unheard.
It's all about the offender, the rehabilitation. No, it's not. It's about the victim.
Nelson Sloan from Lifer Support Alliance has compassion for this perspective, too.
My husband and I are both relatives and survivors of violent crime. You can't say to victims, get over it, because you never get over it. And I understand that.
But, she says,
we have to follow the law.
It's really individual to individual. And there's a lot of guys that are ready to go home. And I think that if someone looked at a lot of people's records, especially like when we were all in San Quentin, if someone had started going over files, they could have picked a whole bunch of people that could have been lifers that could have been let go.
In November 2019, Aline was found suitable.
And luckily, you know, at San Quentin, I was going to college, gaining analytical reading skills and writing skills. And I applied that to the self-help group material. And I had some very poignant moments in groups where I realized the totality of the harm I had done to someone.
His change and growth made him, in the eyes of the commissioners, no longer a threat and safe to return home. But he had no release date. Then in July, as San Quentin was reeling from the COVID outbreak, Aline was told to pack up his cell. After 24 years of incarceration, he was going home.
So two officers come to the door, and they're like, you're Aline, right? And I'm like, yeah. I said, where are we going now, upstairs? They go, hell no, we're going to L.A. You ready? And I was like, what do you mean we're going to L.A.? Dude, we're about to put you in the car. You're going to L.A. to your quarantine hotel right now. Do you need to go to the bathroom? I was like, hell no, let's go.
Aline hopped into a van that sped over the San Rafael Bridge across the San Francisco Bay.
Even though you're in San Quentin and you see the water just looks so beautiful. I swear I sat there the entire five-hour ride to L.A. just looking out the window.
He checked into his travel lodge for 2 mandatory weeks of quarantine.
Well, when they first shut the door, I like made sure that they were far away, and I went, yes, and I jumped jumped on the bed a couple of times, you know, on my back, like, I can't believe it.
Aline has been out for 4 months now. He's looking forward to getting licensed as a truck driver. And when I asked him what the best part of freedom is, he didn't hesitate.
Obviously, hugging my mom for the first time, I was just totally in tears. It just pulls on my heartstrings.
As California struggles to contain COVID inside prisons, Aline and other lifers hope the state will look beyond the most politically palatable releases of nonviolent offenders and consider those with long-term sentences too. For KCRW, I'm Lucy Kopp.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Jonathan Bastian, in for Steve Chiotakis. This election was a big year for drugs. Oregon decriminalized possession of hard drugs, becoming the first state to ever pass legislation of this kind. Plus, the state also legalized psilocybin, the active ingredient in magic mushrooms. So could similar measures be coming down the pike for California and even for LA County? California Senator Scott Wiener has announced that he plans to introduce a bill that would decriminalize psychedelics like magic mushrooms. He plans to put that on the docket in 2021. Here to tell us more is attorney Griffin Thorne from Harris Bricken. Hey, Griffin.
Hey, Jonathan. Good to be talking to you today.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. So first, let's unpack what it means for a state or city to decriminalize a drug.
Yeah, decriminalization does not mean legalization. People often mix the terms up. And in fact, a handful of cities across the United States, from Denver to Oakland to Santa Cruz, Ann Arbor, and Washington, D.C., have all decriminalized psilocybin and in some cases other psychedelic plants, which just really means that the existing criminal laws stay there, but local law enforcement is directed not to enforce those laws or to at least make enforcement a very low priority. So in effect, federal law doesn't change, state law doesn't change, but people who possess, you know, very small amounts for personal use or consumption may be at lower risk of being arrested from, you know, local police officers.
Yeah, and I've always been curious how this actually works. So let's say you get pulled over and you have psilocybin and the police find it on you. So what you're saying is that you may not get arrested even if you're found with the drug?
Potentially. I mean, again, it depends on what kind of police officer is pulling someone over. If it's federal or state, like highway patrol, nothing's changed. But if it's local city police, then they may, in their discretion, not arrest the person. So for things like minor possession, you know, in those cases, it'll probably change. But for commercial activities, so if someone's selling it, for example, nothing has changed, right? Those decriminalization measures do not provide for a commercial market.
Right. Okay. And so these laws were passed in Oregon. They're a big deal because they're statewide. And that means that with psilocybin, there will be a regulatory framework created, right? But just to be clear on this, I mean, does this mean that folks in Oregon will just be able to take psilocybin recreationally?
No. Well, I mean, so there's sort of two tracks. Oregon decriminalized all drugs, and they went a little bit further than the cities because they actually did change some of the penalties from actual arrest to just fines. So, you know, if someone's taking this stuff recreationally, then, you know, that's decriminalized. But for legal use of it in a few years when the market's created, it's only going to be for therapeutic / medical use. So sort of like medical marijuana in California, but much, much more regulated.
Okay. And where does that stand in states like Oregon or other districts? Are we at that point yet?
No. Oregon's the first state to have done anything like this. And basically what's going to happen is starting next month and for a period of 2 years, a committee is going to be developed in Oregon that will, it's sort of like a task force that will create regulations and figure out how to regulate the industry. And people will be able to apply for licenses to manufacture and provide it for therapeutic purposes starting in 2023.
Yeah. And what I understand about this is that it's going to be highly controlled. I mean, you may have to be with a doctor, a psychiatrist, maybe even a psychotherapist in a very controlled setting, right?
So yes and no. I mean, you do have to be in a controlled setting. People aren't going to be able to take this stuff home. It's going to all have to be within a licensed facility. But the interesting thing is it's not actually a doctor or therapist who necessarily needs to give it. It's anyone who can get the license to. They don't even have to have an advanced degree. They just have to go through training and potential licensing to get that certification to be able to administer psilocybin.
Wow. Okay. So there's still some questions there and a little bit more leeway than I would have thought. But I mean, this brings me to California. As I mentioned, Senator Scott Wiener plans to introduce some sort of legislation regarding psychedelics. What do we know about the bill he plans to introduce?
Very little at this stage. He's talked about it on Twitter and it's been reported a lot over the last few weeks. But I mean, at this point, it would probably be just limited to decriminalization. So sort of like what I mentioned a few minutes ago with the cities or with the decriminalization statewide measure in Oregon, where possession of a small amount of it, and this would not be just limited to psilocybin, but other plant substances as well, possession would not lead to arrest by state or local police. But, you know, again, it wouldn't change federal law and it wouldn't create a commercial market at this point in time.
Right. Do you think it has a chance of passing?
I think the more narrow it is, the higher the chance it has of passing, right? You're seeing cities all across the state that are considering, or in fact, you know, two large cities in the state have already adopted decriminalization efforts. You know, and just nationally, attitudes towards drugs are changing. So if we're just talking about decriminalization, I do think it has a decent chance of passing. If it had been a bill to, let's say, legalize, sort of like Oregon did, it's a much more uphill battle in this state.
And, you know, it's always made me wonder when it comes to drugs in California. We think of California as such a deeply blue and progressive state, and yet we're always years behind states like Oregon and Washington when it comes to decriminalizing or just legalizing drugs. I mean, we saw this in cannabis as well. Why do you think the state is just a little bit more reticent to kind of jump into the mix on these subjects?
Well, I mean, just look at the election maps from last month. There's a lot of red in California, and I think that it impacts drug policy a lot. Even when cannabis was passed in this state for recreational use a few years ago, the vote was a pretty narrow margin. And, you know, you see things today for cannabis, like a lot of resistance from cities all across the state to adopting cannabis programs. So, you know, the same thing is going to apply for psychedelics, possibly even more since, you know, they can present much different and in some cases more intense public health issues. You know, if people, for example, were driving, you know, that's always a fear of prohibitionists that people could get behind the wheel on this stuff. So, you know, in the state of California, it's always going to be an uphill battle convincing the large group of conservatives in the state to support something like this.
Right. I mean, do you think this might pass or there may be more kind of liberal policies in places like LA County following the lead of cities like Santa Cruz or Oakland?
I do think other cities, maybe not LA County, but I can't see why other cities in the county would not follow suit. I mean, I expect cities like Berkeley and San Francisco in the next year or two to do similar things to what Oakland did. It may happen down here, but I'm just not aware right now of any efforts to do that just yet.
You know, just to kind of wrap this up, I had a chance to speak with an NYU researcher who's working really closely on psilocybin studies. And I mean, there have been some amazing breakthroughs with things like anxiety, PTSD, alcoholism. And that conversation may be happening on places like public radio. But do you think for the general public, there's an awareness that there are some serious clinical trials out there with psychedelics and that our perception of these drugs may be changing?
Yeah, I do think there's a big discussion about this going on. It's reported on a lot. The FDA is researching and has approved research into two or three different psychedelic drugs that's ongoing and is in pretty advanced stage right now. I think people are starting to wake up to the fact that they have some very strong therapeutic potentials. And so it's important to have these discussions like we're having right now because people need to be aware when this does come up for vote that there actually may be some serious benefits and it's not just a recreational drug that people would be taking. It has potential to really affect, you know, some serious mental health disorders.
Mm. Griffin Thorne is an attorney with Harris Bricken. We appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thanks.
Onward with Greater LA. I'm Jonathan Bastian in for Steve Chiotakis. It's a beautiful sunny day. Let's head to the beach. It's a little chilly out there, but for surfing diehards like David Matuzak, that just means putting on a wetsuit. Dave doesn't just surf, he studies the sport, and he's written an encyclopedic 1,500-page coffee table book about it. It's called San Onofre, Memories of a Legendary Surfing Beach. Well, Dave, from one surfer to another, it's a pleasure to have you on Greater LA. Thanks for joining us.
Aloha, Jonathan, and thanks for having me this morning.
All right, this is a wonderful book, and it's about 12 pounds. It's a hefty one. How did this thing come together?
Well, I had an old surfing friend that I played beach volleyball with and surfed with for 40 years. His name was Wally Dusler. We lost him last year, just 6 weeks shy of his 100th birthday. He began surfing San Onofre in 1937. And in the last years of his life, he began to tell me some stories about the old days of surfing. And I said, Wally, let's put these together into what I had originally envisioned to be a 50 to 100 page booklet of Wally's memories of San Onofre. Well, Wally told his friends what we were doing, and his contemporaries, who were all in their late 80s and early 90s at the time, this is 8 years ago, they said, hey, well, we have memories too. And they invited me to their homes. I did oral histories on each one of them. They opened up their personal family photo albums, and I scanned hundreds of photographs of the earliest days of California surfing that the world's never seen before. And that's how the project became a runaway train. And 8 years of full-time work later, San Onofre released about 6 weeks ago now. It's going to be in the South Bay from the surf shops today for the first time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, surf culture has exploded, obviously, up and down the coast. It's a, you know, it's a huge industry now, and world surf tours. But you capture this really interesting quiet era of California surfing really early on. And I mean, this goes back to the 30s, right?
That's correct. We can document the first surfing being done at San Onofre in 1933. It may have occurred earlier, very likely by a fellow named George Freeth, who is considered to be the father of modern surfing, or sometimes referred to as the father of California surfing.
Tell me a little bit about him. I mean, what role does he play in this book?
Well, he came from Hawaii, came to California in 1907, and he had actually been a surfing instructor and a water safety instructor in Hawaii in the late 1800s. In fact, one of his students was the famous writer Jack London. And he got a letter of introduction, came over by steamer ship here to Venice Beach area. And he was hired by one of the big land speculators in Venice Beach to put on surfing exhibitions. And a couple years later, in 1909, he moved up the beach to Redondo Beach, where he was working for Henry Huntington, the famous land developer. It was a come-on to get people to ride the electric train from Los Angeles out to the coast and come and look at the lots for sale. They were developing the coastal communities in those days. We know that he rode trains down to Balboa in San Diego, and it's very likely that he could have jumped off the train and surfed at a number of spots between Redondo and San Diego, and one of those being San Onofre, which is right next to the railroad tracks. So he would have seen those waves.
Mm. One thing that always strikes me about San Onofre is just what an unusual place it is to look around you when you surf there. I remember when I was out there my first time, I saw a nuclear power plant, which has been decommissioned. I saw tanks driving around the Pendleton Marine Base. I mean, you have this very strange mashup of California culture happening on that shared strip of coastline. Can you just talk about what an unusual place it is?
Well, it's the most unique mixture of cultures and subcultures anywhere in California. It started out as a cattle ranch, a Spanish land grant rancho, Rancho San Onofre. So you had cowboys in the early days, then you had farmers, and then along comes the Marine Corps in 1942 and takes all of San Onofre by eminent domain to create Camp Pendleton. And for a long time, they chased the surfers out of most parts of San Onofre. And after hearing dozens of stories of surfers being chased out of the water and having their surfboards confiscated, and I thought, you know, it might be fun to hear the other side of the story. So I put a notice in Leatherneck Magazine, the worldwide magazine for the Marine Corps, and reached out and got six responses from the military policemen themselves between 1942 and 1972. And it's a kind of a cat and mouse game between the MPs and the surfers. So along come the surfers in the 30s. So you have this four different cultures that are mingling together right there on the coast. And by the early and mid 70s, then the Camp Pendleton under the Department of the Navy. They leased all of that land to California State Parks, and it became a state park and was opened up as a public beach henceforth.
Well, David Matuszak is the author of San Onofre, Memories of a Legendary Surfing Beach. I wish we could talk about this for a lot longer. It's a wonderful subject. Thanks for the time.
Jonathan, thank you very much, and I'll see you on the waves.
Well, that's it for today. Tomorrow, how the largest gas leak in U.S. history turned one town in the San Fernando Valley into a community of environmental activists. We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA, where you can hear all our stories and subscribe to the podcast as well. Once again, kcrw.com/greaterLA. Big thanks to our team, Christian Bordahl, Jenna Cagle, Angel Carrera, Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Mario Diaz, Mario Saavedra, Christina Hermosissima, and Amy Taw. I'm Jonathan Bastian, sitting in for Steve Chiotakis. Have a great night. We'll see you tomorrow.